You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you...
Back in 1965, Bob Dylan had reached a creative plateau. The music industry was driving him crazy. He put down his guitar, retreated to a cabin in Woodstock, New York, figuring this spot would be the place where he would begin his new life, whatever that would be. But there would be no new life, at least not in the way he might have thought. After just a few days, he did start scribbling lyrics. They seemed to come from somewhere else, and it seemed he couldn't stop. Here's how he described those moments and where his classic songs came from so long ago in an interview with the late Ed Bradley from 60 Minutes.
It came from right out of that wellspring of creativity.
That you've written and look back at it and say, whoa, that surprised me.
I used to. I don't do that anymore. I don't know how I got to write those songs.
What do you mean you don't know how?
Well, those early songs were like almost magically written. Darkness at the break of noon, shadows even the silver spoon, handmade blade, a child, something like that. There's a magic to that, and it's not Siegfried and Roy kind of magic. You know, it's a different kind of a penetrating magic.
Bob Dylan talking about the magic. Like a Rolling Stone was just one of the songs that came from that wellspring he was talking about there. Gates of Eden, It's All Right, Mom, many, many others. So what prompted Dylan's moment of insight there? And where do most artists and inventors get their creative impulses? A new book by author and journalist and our good friend Jonah Lehrer explores the science behind imagination. The book is Imagine, How Creativity Works. And Jonah joins us today from KERA, public radio station in Dallas. Jonah, welcome to the program again.
Thanks for having me again.
You know, this book is so fascinating because not only does it tell great stories of creativity lost and found, but it also mirrors that story with a story of how the brain is working. And there's so much here. Let's confine it to three areas, and let's begin with the many creative artists that have found chemicals to stimulate their brain. You mentioned W.H. Auden, the poet. Why does he love benzedrine, and why does it work?
Well, the reason I think so many artists have long engaged in self-medication and self-experimentation really speaks to the difficulties of the creative process. I mean, creativity is so, so hard. If it were easy, it would have been done already. That song would already exist. That poem would have been written. And so they're forced to seek out every possible edge, whether it's Dylan had a little medicine cabinet that he liked to travel with, or W.H. Auden, who, beginning in the late 1930s when he moved to New York, he began taking benzedrine, which is an amphetamine. At the time, it was legal. It was prescribed for things like asthma. But for Auden, this was a crucial tool that helped him boost his attention. It turned him into a poetry machine, so he could spend hour after hour after hour just focusing on a single line of poetry, a single metaphor. And what interested me about, you know, Auden's experimentation with amphetamines was how it changed his poetry. When you look at his most anthologized poems, they almost all come from this short window of time when he was most addicted to amphetamines. I'm a big fan of his late poetry as well, but there is something about this amphetamine poetry. It's so clear, it's so transparent, it's so precise, and I think that helps explain its popularity.
Let's forget the drugs for a moment because I don't want people thinking that we're necessarily endorsing that sort of a lifestyle, but you use this as a door into the brain to figure out how it works. How does the brain mediate these two phenomena of creativity, the hard work of creativity and the sort of inspirational attention that you need to have to catch something that comes into your brain almost randomly?
Yes, one certainly doesn't want to endorse amphetamines. As Auden would later discover, they are very addictive and come with all sorts of terrible side effects, which is why they're illegal now. But what they help us do is they trigger the release of dopamine in the midbrain, and that makes it easier. That makes the world more exciting. So even seemingly tedious things, tedious stimuli like a single line of poetry, you can pay attention to it for hours. Normally our attention is flits about. It's so fickle. It's always getting distracted. And yet amphetamines help sharpen the spotlight. They make it a little bit easier to pay attention for a long time. And when we need to put in the work, when we need to go through edit after edit, revision after revision, that's going to be essential. However, there is a very different type of creativity, which Bob Dylan likes to talk about. It was wonderful to hear his voice this morning. And that's when we have these moments of insight, these epiphanies, these revelations that come in the shower. And that, it turns out, that kind of creativity isn't helped by attention. In fact, the opposite seems to be true. When you need a moment of insight, more attention will often backfire. So chugging caffeine when you need an epiphany will actually get in the way. Instead, the research suggests that you'll be most likely to have that epiphany, to have that breakthrough when you're relaxed, when you go for a walk, when you take a warm shower, when you stop thinking about work. The answer will only arrive after you stop looking for it.
Or in Dylan's case, go into a cabin in Woodstock, in New York. Let's talk a little bit about the other really fascinating set of stories in your book, how cities and the environment can encourage and summon creativity, not only in individuals, but in groups of people.
Yeah, this is one of the great themes of the 21st century. We are moving to cities. We are flocking to cities like never before. And in the book, I profile the work of Jeffrey West, who's a theoretical physicist at the Santa Fe Institute. And he data mines cities, trying to figure out what their secret sauce is. Why when we cram ourselves into a small space, when we share sidewalks, why we become more productive. And what his data shows is that as cities get bigger, as a metropolis expands, everyone in that city becomes more innovative. They invent more patents per capita, more trademarks. They make more money. By every metric you look at, they just look to be a little bit smarter. And he argues it's simply the human friction of the city. It's too many people crammed into a very small space, all these knowledge spillovers, and that's a good thing. And that's why cities really are the engine of innovation.
Did this engine produce Silicon Valley, the auto industry in Detroit, the innovations that we associate with, some communities in India?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you look at the history of innovation, the 20th century and the 21st century, it really is inseparable from the metropolis. And that gets back to the fact that it is the human friction that makes the sparks. It is just all those people bumping into each other. And that's a very good thing. And I think what's also interesting is that you go back 15 years ago and people are talking about the death of geography, that now we've got Skype and email. Why should we cram into a city? Why should we pay the expensive rents and put up with the crime and the bad schools and the traffic? And so cities would become obsolete. But that hasn't happened at all. Instead, the opposite has happened, that more people are moving to cities than have ever moved to cities. That I think we still recognize the need to exist in meat space, in physical space, in the flesh with other people. One of my favorite factoids is that since the invention of Skype, attendance at business conferences has doubled.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And I think that speaks to the fact that even though we have these tools that would allow us to share information remotely, we still know there is something about the serendipity of coming together in person.
I mean, it's as though creativity itself is a networked phenomenon, just not through Skype. It's face-to-face contact and all of the high-resolution information that you can exchange when you're crammed together in those spaces. Jonah Lehrer, author of Imagine, How Creativity Works. You describe and then appear to solve the so-called Shakespeare paradox. Describe it and then solve it for us, please.
Oh, I don't know if I solve it by any stretch of the imagination, but this is a mystery I've long been interested in. Sociologists refer to them as ages of excess genius, and they are these sudden flourishings of talent. My favorite, just as a writer, is Elizabethan England, where all of a sudden you get not just William Shakespeare living in London, but you get Christopher Marlowe, you get John Donne, you get Francis Bacon. The list goes on and on. These are people who essentially invented modern English literature, and they all lived in the exact same city at the exact same time. It's quite perplexing. For a long time, historians have just assumed these are these historical flukes, these random clottings of talent, as they put it. But I think one can begin to extract some trends from these various ages of excess genius, from Elizabethan England, from Renaissance Florence, from ancient Athens. And what you often see are, there's a big expansion in the educational system. So Shakespeare's father was a glover who signed his name with a mark, and yet Shakespeare was being given lessons in classic literature at the age of 7 and 8 by an Oxford-educated teacher for free. You also see an expansion in the transmission of information. So the birth of the public The birth of the publishing industry took place in London a few years before Shakespeare really came onto the scene. That allowed him, that gave him access to all sorts of stories, which he translated into his plays. So he was able to take this mediocre melodrama called Hamlet and turn into the Hamlet we know today. He pilfered almost all his plots. So those are some of the things, those are some of the themes, I think, that recur in Ages of Excess Genius. And Bill James, the pioneer of sabermetrics, he makes this very interesting point that America, 21st century America, is really good at creating a certain type of genius. You know, we just pump them out, and that's athletic genius. That our basketball players, baseball players, they compete all over the world. We win a lot of medals at the Olympics. We just have to take those same mechanisms that allow us to pump out athletic genius and transfer it to other kinds of genius.
Well, geniuses like Jonah Lehrer, author of Imagine, How Creativity Works. We'll leave you with the genius of Bob Dylan once again. Jonah Lehrer joined us from KERA in Dallas, Texas. Thanks, Jonah.
Thank you.
When are you creative? You know you can reach us. And have a creative and productive weekend, won't you? At 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.